From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the program, a researcher taps the members of a local-based organization to learn more about the genetics of obesity.
We're now into the fourth and fifth generation of collection of this data, which makes it really significant in terms of the possibilities for tracing tendencies.
Milwaukee Magazine compiles a food lover's guide to the city. As Porgy and Bess opens at the Skylight Theater, Bill Tyson reflects on the end of his time here.
It felt like it was time for a new chapter for me in my life, and also probably a new chapter for the Skylight. It's been an incredible 9 years. I hope I've contributed to the Skylight and to the Milwaukee arts community, but I wanted to go while I still loved it.
And a new magazine launches with a single edible focus. Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for being with us today. Not long ago, we featured the work of a local researcher in better establishing links between genetics and obesity. That research is not the only cutting-edge local work being done in the field, however. A partnership between a Medical College of Wisconsin research team and a Milwaukee-based patient support group is reporting significant results as well in learning more about the ties between genes and obesity. Dr. Sherry Zhang is an instructor in the Human and Molecular Genetics Center at the Medical College and has worked with a national organization called TOPS, Take Off Pounds Sensibly. Barbara Cady is president of the group, and she and Zhang are in the studio with us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
We appreciate the opportunity.
When you say you look at genes related to obesity, and I gather there are several new genes you've identified which appear to be linked. What exactly is the relationship? I mean, is it saying that a person with these genes or a particular version of these genes is likely to be obese or become obese?
Yeah, so it's a very good question. And as you know, people's genomes are very different. If I compare mine with yours, we're going to find probably 3 million bases, which is the building block of the genome, that many differences between you and me. And you can imagine in a population of 1,000 people, and that will be just greatly increased in the differences. So we use the differences in the sequence of the DNA and associate that with the differences in your trait, such as obesity and related traits. So from there, we'll be able to pinpoint the genes that link your DNA differences with your traits differences.
Well, and so how strong do you see this connection at this stage?
We have statistically significant associations between the genes we identified and our obesity traits. So a lot of downstream work has to be done to confirm the functionality of those genes. But the evidence we saw was pretty strong.
Is this an aha moment, if you will? We found these two genes, and now we think we're really onto something.
We are on something, especially because this work has been built on years of collaboration between MCW and TOPS Club. And over the past three decades, a significant progress has been made to finer narrowing down to the regions that harbor certain genes. And in this work we published recently in Obesity Journal, we were be able to, for the first time, pinpoint which particular genes are playing a role. Of course, their obesity is a complex disease. That means it's being influenced by multiple factors. And the current thinking is it's determined by the gene, the environment, and the interaction between the two.
That was my next question, is what we know about the relationship between environmental factors and these two particular genes.
That we don't know, and I have a special interest of myself in looking into that. There's something, it's called epigenetics, that link the genes with the environment. So that's definitely the next thing to look at.
Well, and Barb Cady, this is maybe an obvious question, but the TOPS Club is not a research-specific club. It is more, I guess, patient-centered, if you will. Why was it important for you to be involved in the research arm of work on obesity?
Well, we are a nonprofit organization, and it's one of the key facets of the organization. We are member-based, member-driven, member-determined in our mission, and the mission of the people who suffer from this disease, from obesity, is to at some day find a cure, and if not a cure, at least an effective method of control that does no harm. Because I'm sure you're aware that through the years there have been many, many modalities offered, some of which do critical harm to individuals through time. And our mission is to try to find a healthy way of living for all of us that deal with this disease on a daily basis.
Now, I gather at the heart of your work is something called metabolic syndrome. Mm-hmm. Where does that come in? What is metabolic syndrome, and how does your work have implications for it?
Sure. So metabolic syndrome is a specialized form of obesity. So it started with increased body composition changes. And the definition of metabolic syndrome has been evolved over the years. But the most commonly accepted definition will be including increased abdominal fat distribution and insulin resistance and lipids abnormalities and some increased profile or abnormal profile of cytokines or adipokines, which is stuff you secreted from your adipocytes and other cells. It is very common. And once you have those manifestations of those traits of metabolic syndrome, your risk for developing cardiovascular diseases and type 2 diabetes will be greatly increased.
Well, and so what do we know about the genetics of metabolic syndrome? People say all the time, well, you know, my family is big boned, or, you know, my grandfather always had a pot belly, so will you, or so will I. Is the science now supporting these kinds of ancestral associations?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a way we can assess the heritable part, which is you can pass it down from your grandfather to your father and to you. And that portion of your traits differences is genetically determined. That's how we define it.
What does it say, though, about the inevitability of developing these traits? Is there – I mean, I think this – I would imagine this is something that TOPS is especially interested in. What does it say about the implications for doing something about it?
We could help to early detect the mutations you have in your genes that inherited from your ancestors. And from there, you could have a plan to change your diet or lifestyles down the road. So, you know, there's a very non-invasive intervention you could do, you know, increase your calcium intake if, you know, some enzymes are being expressed low, which will lead to certain cardiovascular diseases. I'm just making that
sure,
as an
sure.
example. But things like that. So early detection, I'm really a believer of early detection and personalized medicine. So if you can know them early, and you can definitely do something in your life.
Barb, Katie, does this make for a more, I don't know, complicated dynamic when it comes to talking about weight loss? I would imagine on one hand, it is very comforting to know if you are someone who is dealing with obesity issues that perhaps that, you know, there was a genetic component to this. This was not just about eating too much or not exercising enough. But at the same time, genes are somewhat harder to work against than cheeseburgers.
Well, we all have certain genetic heritage, and your genes do not necessarily mandate. They can predispose, but if you're aware of what your genetic history is, then you can make modification. And one of the nicest things of this association with the medical college that directly applies to our members and how we cope is they've been very encouraging about the impact of small changes through time, making significant differences in all of the profiles associated with metabolic syndrome.
Small changes like?
Walking a little bit more, not engaging in a full impact course of aerobics when you're 100 pounds overweight, eating more healthily, not cutting out everything, but eating more healthily, trying to lose 10% of the excess weight as opposed to saying you must lose it all to get healthy. They really have been very strong in their support of us that as you make progress, things improve. You don't have to wait until you're at ideal goal weight for the impact to be felt and experienced and your quality of life to improve.
This is an incremental approach, you're saying?
Yes, absolutely.
Can you talk about the relationship between the medical college and TOPS? What was it that TOPS was able to provide that helped in your research?
Genes.
Yes.
When they initiated this particular study, they did come to us and ask if our members would be willing to participate by donating DNA. And we did go through a massive collection of DNA from various members of our organization.
Were people pretty enthusiastic?
They were totally supportive. I think they would have lined up at the medical college in droves if they had permitted that. But the medical college had specific guidelines as to who they wished to test. They did match sister pairs with a lean sibling, and you had to have a living parent. We are now into the fourth and fifth generation of collection of this data, which makes it really significant in terms of the possibilities mm-hmm. for tracing tendencies. Mm-hmm. And we're honored to continue to be a part of this because we are hopeful that while there may not be one magic bullet out there, there will eventually be an effective way to control this. Because people who suffer from obesity are not stupid or lazy or unmotivated. They are trying their best to cope with a very difficult, very complex problem.
Well, and do you think – I get a sense from this interview and from others I've done in the past, have we been too quick to oversimplify the obesity dynamic in the past?
That's an interesting mm-hmm. question. It's a very interesting question. Eating less and moving more definitely are the recommended beginning steps that you take. They're not necessarily enough all by themselves. You have to take into account so many other factors. Often, your own body works against you. And if you've had a history of losing and regaining weight, everything changes somewhat because your metabolic rate actually gets somewhat suppressed as you try to struggle with controlling this disease through time. So what was true for you at the beginning is no longer true. You're actually changed. Your body fat distribution has altered. The rate at which you burn, what you eat has changed. You're actually fatter now than when you began, even though your same weight may be the
I totally agree. It's a dynamic process, you know, throughout your life. And you can be very different to begin with, but along the road, you could change your body composition, insulin resistance, and everything else around that pattern. So it's really far more complex than just eating less and exercise more.
Well, and I wonder, you obviously learned a lot from the genes from the people who donated them mm-hmm. As part of this study. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you got something from the whole person, the interaction, the work with TOPS as an organization or the people within TOPS?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've been to one of the several of the International Recognition Day, we call it RDs of TOPS. Every time I was so touched by, you know, the passion and of those members. And from my work, I know every day I'm holding their DNAs, and that's probably the most private thing they could share. You know, other than that, they financially support us over this so many years. And it's really, really a great thing to have. And I'm really honored to be able to work with them on that.
Where does the research go from here, and does TOPS' relationship with it continue?
I want to say that we actually, after this obesity paper we just focused on, we already have two more papers published in the past 2 months or so. So, of course, all this were built on the long-term work we've been doing together, as I described earlier. So I just know that for sure that this is the beginning of a series of great work that's going to be published. So just stay tuned for that.
To quote Casablanca, this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
That's right.
Well, Sherry Zhang and Barb Cady, thank you both so much.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Sherry Zhang is an instructor in the Human and Molecular Genetics Center at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Barb Cady is president of the national organization called TOPS, Take Off Pounds Sensibly, which is based in Milwaukee. The organization and the college work together on recent research into the genetics of obesity, which will be published in an upcoming edition of the journal Obesity. We'll go behind the scenes on Milwaukee Magazine's Food Lover's Guide when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. As we've heard on shows past, Milwaukee is in something of a food renaissance for restaurants, for ingredients, and simply for the interest of people in what goes onto their plates. Ann Christensen typically writes about restaurants in her role as dining critic for Milwaukee Magazine, but in the May issue, she served as editor for what the magazine hopes is a definitive food lover's guide to the city. Ann Christensen joins us in the studio now to talk about the guide. Welcome back to the show.
Good to see you as well.
You typically write about restaurants, but what you guided and helped bring together was something larger. What was the guiding principle behind the Food Lover's Guide to Milwaukee?
You know, first of all, this is a story that other city magazines have done. And we had looked at L.A., you know, especially on the east, on the West Coast, rather, have done a fantastic job of doing this sort of story. So we thought this is something we need to do. And but ours would need to be different because, you know, if you go out to the West Coast, you're dealing with a lot of produce, a lot of fresh things. And that's just really not something that we would do. But, you know, knowing that Wisconsin has all these amazing cheesemongers and great butcher shops and lots of other things. You know, we've got the Spice House here. You know, we've got all these incredible ethnic grocery stores. So we knew that ours was going to take a different tact. But I don't know. I mean, I felt like this is a story that could have gone on and on and on. It's just how do you cap it off? I felt like the overriding principle was not so much a person who likes to go out to a restaurant, but someone who likes to entertain and likes to cook.
Well, and you write about the kind of delicious, if I can use that word, irony of going after the perception of Milwaukee as a meat and cheese kind of place by spotlighting what's right about the meat and cheese scene.
Well, I that's something that we would never shy away from, even though there might be this stereotype that, you know, Wisconsin is all, you know, cheese and meat and those sorts of things. But when you look at awards, you know, and then the cheese competitions, I mean, Wisconsin is always up there. And we're not just talking about cheddar. I mean, I spotlight cheeses that you wouldn't normally think of, you know, in relation to Wisconsin. We always think of cheddar or Colby or something like this. But we're talking some really interesting cheeses, really, you know, somewhat unusual and different. And
there's something called a quark cheese.
There's a quark cheese that's made at Clock Shadow Creamery here in Milwaukee, which is one of the few cheeses that's actually made here. And honestly, if you haven't been to Clock Shadow, it's a really fun place because there's also there's Purple Door ice cream. So they're making ice cream right there. There's a woman named Martha who's doing this incredible – I think it's really good. It's called pimento cheese.
This is Martha Kipchak.
Right. And that's it's just a really great spread. And what a fun little place. And if you're into food, it's a great little journey, and you can go and kind of watch them make their products and sample.
Well, and we should clarify the point here that not all of the cheeses that you feature, in fact, most of them, are not actually made in Milwaukee. They are, however, made in Wisconsin.
Well, the key to that, though, was that you could get it here in Milwaukee. There would be enough stores where you could buy it, right? So, or even, you know, there are a lot of products that I included that you may even see on a restaurant menu. For instance, one of the things I was really excited about doing was what we ended up calling the ultimate Wisconsin artisanal cheese plate, which I thought was really fun because, you know, I think that, you know, people don't know maybe what to put on a cheese platter.
Right.
You know, which cheeses would complement each other and which textures should I have? And maybe what kind of charcuterie, can I get a really great jam or a honey or something like this? And so, you know, I was just looking around and looking for things that were locally made and the quality was just there. And so then just slowly kind of assembling things. But there's a smoked trout on that plate, which is from Palmyra, an amazing little trout farm. And, you know, that's you know, obviously not one of the Milwaukee-based ingredients, but that's one that is fantastic, and I loved having it on that platter.
Do you think the attention to quality has always been here? Many of the places that are featured in this story aren't new shops or new products. They have been around for a long, long time.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I mean, there's also we kind of have a running ticker at the bottom of a two-page spread where we just have these products such as Ma Bench Herring, which everybody knows, you know. And I mean, there's definitely things that people are going to recognize on there. But, you know, Sassy Cow Milk, you know, Yuppie Hill Eggs, those aren't, you know, those don't have the longevity of Ma Bench. But they're things, those are products people have come to know.
Right, used to seeing them on the shelf at the grocery
exactly,
store.
Exactly. Whether it's Outpost or even in some of these cases, you're going to get this at Pick and Save. Definitely Ma Bench is available everywhere. And that just, I think that just goes to show how popular those products have become.
When you sent people out, you compiled some of these and some of your fellow editors compiled some of these. What were your instructions to make this authoritative? I mean, this is not just a shopping list.
No. You know, for instance, with butcher shops, I had another editor who was really gung-ho on doing this. This was his thing and he really wanted to do it. And I said, well, you know, you're going to be driving everywhere. You have to go to these places and pick up what you considered. Well, I'm going to tell you, first of all, I'm going to give you a list of some things I want you to buy while you're there, and also scope out some things that maybe the butcher said, hey, this is really fantastic. You should try this. So he was going around buying these things, sampling them, and it came down to quality. That's what it came down to. And so we weren't just trying to do a laundry list of stores in here. It came down to which ones, you know, met our standards. So, but I was really, you know, I was on people to, you know, really to visit all these places and pick up enough stuff. And it was actually a really fun couple months in the office because a lot of things were being, you know, purchased and brought back, like baked goods and chocolates.
I was going to say chocolate figures.
Yeah, but even you should have seen the editors who were gnawing on, you know, just sausages and, some of our editors are really, you know, myself included, really likes a good...
Right, like a jerky.
A jerky, absolutely. In fact, driven by our sports guy, Howie Magner, who was very, very vocal about what he likes in a jerky. We were all eating these things, and it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun when you bring it in-house and people share, and you've got a lot of opinions going, and I think, you know, writers and editors are by their nature very opinionated people. So it was a fun process.
He's not in the studio with us, but what does Howie like in a jerky?
You know, the texture has to be just so. I mean, it has to be chewy, but not so much so that your jaw is really, you know, is like, you know, numb afterwards. For him, I think he doesn't like it too spicy. He likes it to have a lot of flavor, but kind of and smoky. He likes smoky. That's at least what he's told me.
it's some of it is a little intimidating. You read about an 18-year balsamic vinegar or a quark cheese or a tile fish. How user friendly are these places in helping you with ideas to take these products from just being ingredients to being usable ingredients?
Right. Well, that's what's kind of fun about it. That when you mentioned the balsamic, there are a couple stores in Milwaukee where you can go and sample. They're typically sort of olive oil stores.
Right.
That's what they specialize in. They have vinegars as well. But those are the kind of places where you walk in and right away they're gonna give you a little paper cup and say, you need to taste this. It's the only way you can decide what to buy. And so it's really it's interesting to taste. I mean, olive oil by itself, because it's something that maybe people don't often do. But a lot of them are infused, you know, with herbs and things like that. And they're really, really fun and delicious. And there's truffle oils. And once you try these things, I think you become a little bit more. If you're a little gun shy, you get a little bit more adventurous, and you're like, I think I want to serve this with my bread and cheese, and I'm going to use it as a dipping oil or whatever the case might be. But a lot of them, a lot of those types of shops are particularly great at giving you suggestions of how to use the oils, what they go well with, pairing ideas and things of that nature.
It's really an eye-opener to think of it as just, you know, not just another thing to put in your skillet to fry your eggs or your or to, you know, make chicken with.
And another, you know, one of the stores that I love is the Spice House, and there's also Penzies, which are, you know, different branches of the same family. But if you go to that store, I mean, these people are used to having customers walk up to them and say, how do I use this? Or I want to really really great cinnamon, or I need a salt, you know, really unusual salt. And that's one of the things I think is really fun. There are all these different kinds of salt, you know, Himalayan salts and truffle salt. I mean, porcini mushroom salt. These are amazing. And I mean, that's not something you're going to get in the grocery store. So it's like getting you out of going to Pick and Save and going to some of these specialty stores that have such, you know, fantastic products.
Were there aspects to this scene that surprised even you as this came together? Or does anything surprise you at this stage?
No, they do. They absolutely do. You know, actually, I've been surprised. I'm always surprised. I think probably on a daily basis by, you know, every place that I go is really interesting to me. But, you know, we found this guy. For instance, there's also classes in here. You know, how do you, you know, you could go to Glorioso's and learn more about, I don't know, cooking Italian food or sausages, things of that nature. But there's a guy in Mequon who can teach you how to make cheese. And, you know, not just a cheddar cheese. You're going to have blue cheese, gorgonzola, you know, ricotta, butter. I mean, he's showing you how to do all these things. And I thought that was actually pretty fun. I mean, you know, people that are really into, you know, cheeses, I think sometimes maybe they don't realize how easy it is from what I've heard. I haven't done it to make these things, you know, and bring them home, and then they can actually do this at home. So I think there's surprising things that way. The ethnic grocery stores are always really interesting and surprising to me. And, you know, again, I had one of our editors as a little bit of a, you know, a guide going around to these places, someone who a woman who actually spent a lot of time in India. So she was particularly great in the Indian grocery stores, but just fantastic things that she was taking photos of and what she was buying and bringing into the office. Those to me are fascinating and interesting and surprising.
Right. It struck me as I read about the ethnic grocery stores that really you could be from almost any part of the world right now and still in Milwaukee have access to many of the ingredients that you would be used to.
Absolutely. And in actually assembling some of the products that we photographed for the ethnic grocery stores, some of the things were actually products that were made right there. And that's what we really liked because it localized it.
But at the same time, you know, there are pre-made, you know, there are manufactured goods from India or from that I think people would also be used to. And that's actually, it strikes me, being reflected in some of the Pick and Saves and in the Sendix and Sentries of the Milwaukee area, that their ethnic sections are now expanding.
Are growing, absolutely. And places like Woodman's, which are becoming more popular for those types of things. One of the things I didn't include, and at some point down the line I'd really like to do, is get into, you know, more, you know, products for people that have maybe, you know, dietary restrictions and gluten allergies and things of that nature. But it didn't seem to fit in with this. And plus, you know, we had 12 pages and we filled them easily. So somewhere down the line, I think that'll happen.
Another aspect of this I wanted you to touch on, you did touch on it briefly, is fish. That there mm-hmm. are now several really sharp fish stores, fish markets in the Milwaukee area, and it is not necessarily just, you know, just fish from Lake Michigan.
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, you know, one of the places I really like is Empire out in it's actually Milwaukee. I don't think it's actually Elm Grove, but it's sort of borderline
it's like
there.
Milwaukee, yeah, Wauwatosa, it's like, Elm Grove.
But anyway, they always have great stuff, and you can sign up and get their newsletter. I get it. It comes on, you know, a couple times a week, and you can go right on their website and see what is fresh today. Same with St. Paul Fish. You know, you're getting these, you know, incredible, you know, you're getting, you know, maybe it's salmon or it's fresh, it's halibut season, or you've got soft-shell crab, or you want scallops, like the best scallops. I mean, I'm not going to go to a grocery store for that stuff. I don't do that. So, you know, I think it was good to kind of have that segment in here. And the place that we featured, the Palmyra Trout Farm, that has the smoked fish, also has salmon, and they also fresh trout as well. And some of those shops will carry that. Empire does. So it's yet another, there's a little bit of a tie-in there.
It strikes me that maybe the real story behind all of this is the normalization of this scene.
The normalization of...
Like just the fact that it is really part, like foods like this are part of the eating vernacular.
Of the everyday life.
Yeah.
Well, for a lot of people, they are. And I think, you know, just as we talked about some of these products that are finding their way onto conventional or mainstream grocery store shelves, they are becoming more mainstream. You know, at one point in time, like Larry's Brown Deer Market is a big favorite of mine, and I think their cheese selection is fantastic. But, you know, some of those you know, other stores like Glorioso's is getting – I mean, Glorioso's has always been great. It's gotten better since they opened their new location. But there's an Outpost. These places are starting to stock a lot more products, so you don't have to just go to one specific little place to do that, although I would definitely say – go to Larry's. It's a fun store.
And I will confess, I have not yet been there, and I am ashamed to say that.
No, it's you will go in, and it's kind of sensory overload because it's a small store, and there's tons of stuff in there, and plus they have a little deli. So
it is really an amazing scene, and you brought it together so well. Ann Christensen, thanks.
Thank you. Thanks.
Ann Christensen is senior editor and dining critic at Milwaukee Magazine. She is also our regular restaurant contributor. The magazine's Food Lover's Guide is the cover story in the May issue. There is a link to it from WUWM.com. Another break now, and in just a moment, we'll chat with Bill Tyson on the eve of his last production at the Skylight Music Theater. This is Like Effect on WUWM. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Teich. The closing shows of the Skylight Music Theater's current season also mark the end of an era for the theater. Their staging of a new production of the Gershwins' classic Porgy and Bess also marks the last production under the artistic direction of Bill Tyson. It's a stripped-down production. The cast in some productions can number as many as 70, but Skylight's rendition includes only 15. This production is Skylight's first staging of Porgy and Bess, and it's the first Milwaukee production of the play since 1989. Bill Tyson spoke with Lake Effect's Bonnie North about why he wanted this production to end his own run at the Skylight Theater.
From the first day I got there, I knew I wanted, at some point, I hoped the Skylight would be able to produce Porgy and Bess. In our 54-year history, it has never been done on the Skylight stage. And it's such an important work, the most, I think, important American opera ever written, and really perfect for us to do. But has its own challenges, of course, that are different from any of the things that we normally do. So it's incredibly exciting to be bringing it to the Skylight, both just for the first time and as my final production as artistic director.
Well, what are some of those challenges?
Well, primarily the casting. We were able to find quite a few talented singers here in the Milwaukee area, but we also had to bring in quite a few people from out of town, which we do on a varying basis from show to show. But because the cast is primarily, with the exception of one cast member, African-American, we had to look beyond where we normally look for a lot of our casting needs. And that's just a challenge for us. Also, this is the opera version. It is not the version that was just on Broadway last year. This is the opera version, a chamber opera version, which is specifically suited for the Cabot stage for our 358-seat theater. But it is an opera version. So finding the opera singers who are available, Milwaukee doesn't have the largest operatic talent pool, so we often have to bring in opera singers from out of town, and the specific needs of this show were even greater than normal.
I think a lot of people might not realize that there are more than one version of this opera, that it is both an opera, a folk opera. It's also a musical theater piece. Now, did Gershwin create all of those different pieces, or were those created after he wrote the initial show?
It premiered in 1935, and initially the entire piece was done as a concert version in New York, and it was over 4 hours long. It then moved into a Broadway theater, and Gershwin made many cuts from that initial version into the production that played on Broadway. And it's always been, for years and years, it's been debated, is it a musical, is it an opera? It really is an opera. Over the course of that time, Gershwin always wrote it with recitatives. There was no spoken dialogue except for the characters who are not African American. They do speak. In all these years since then, the past 80 years, many different versions of the piece have been done, taking the recits out, adding dialogue in. But this is the opera version. This truly is the opera version. Gershwin did a lot of different cuts in his life. I mean, he only lived 2 more years after the show premiered. But in his time, he did some different versions of it. We're really sticking true to those cuts that he initially made, Gershwin himself made in 1935 when it moved onto the Broadway stage. But he always considered it a folk opera and truly an opera, an American opera. And I think that is indeed what the piece is. And as time has come to tell, at the time people weren't sure. But over these years, it really has evolved into truly an operatic form. There was a production on Broadway just last season that was kind of a reimagining of the piece that did bring dialogue back into it and took a lot of liberties with the piece. Different people had different opinions about that piece. It did win the Tony Award for Best Revival on Broadway, but that definitely was a musical theater version of Porgy and Bess. Our production is a chamber opera version of Gershwin's original work.
And, of course, the songs that come out of that, a lot of people know Summertime. I think it's probably the most famous song
is.
Of that. But what are some of the other wonderful Gershwin tunes that came out of this?
Well, there's I Got Plenty of Nuttin', which is probably the second most popular tune from it. Bess, You Is My Woman Now, which is a gorgeous song, a duet for Porgy and Bess to sing as well. It Ain't Necessarily So, which is a wonderful song that the character of Sport and Life sings to open Act 2 in our production. It's just chock full of amazing, amazing tunes. And but yet it's all written together as a total piece that Gershwin looked at. There's an amazing quote that I found from Gershwin that talks about when he was writing the piece. He visited Charleston, South Carolina, where Porgy and Bess is set. And he was talking to a reporter from the newspaper there, just beginning the process, and this is how he described what he thought the work would be. Gershwin said himself, "Porgy and Bess will be a serious attempt to put into operatic form a purely American theme. If I am successful, it will resemble a combination of the drama and romance of Carmen and the beauty of Meistersinger. If you can imagine that." So I love that Gershwin knew at that point what it wanted to be. And when you hear the piece, if you're familiar with either of those two operas, you can hear that those were influences for Gershwin when he wrote Porgy and Bess. But yet it truly is his own. It sounds like nothing else. He had his own, that jazz influence. And it's just an amazing score from start to finish. And he created something that I truly think is the most important American opera of the last century.
One of the things, too, that I find very interesting about it is that there's always been charges of racism against it, too, because he was white, he was Jewish. You know, he was coming at it from an outside perspective and attempting to show African-American experience. Although I believe the libretto was written by an African-American. Is that true?
That is not true.
Is not true.
No, it is not true. It was DuBose Hayward, who is a white man who grew up in Charleston and really lived in the world of all of the characters that he wrote about. He initially started out as a novel. The novel Porgy came out in 1925. Then he and his wife created a play version of that novel in 1927, and then the opera came in 1935. So there was no African-American involved in the writing of the piece. And I think at the time it was interesting because it played all over the world. And back in the 40s and 50s, they were concerned that this is what they were showing to other parts of the world. This is what they assumed all African-Americans' lives were like in America at the time. But it was such a seminal piece for the music and for what Gershwin had created. But there has been controversy, not as much now, but up until the 1970s, it was a very controversial piece in the fact that did it really just create stereotypes of African-American people.
So how have people mitigated that? When you do a production of this, I'm sure it's something you have to think about.
It definitely is. But I think what's important to look back at is it's Charleston, South Carolina in the early 1930s. It is depicting the lives of these people as they actually were then. It wasn't the best time. It was a challenging time on many levels. But like many pieces that we look at that we go back to, I think it's important to be true to what was happening historically at that time, which the creators of this piece were. When it was a little closer to that time, I think it was harder to differentiate that. But now that we can look back that it's almost 80 years since it was written, it does make a very big difference into the world of what we're looking back at and that it is historically correct. And it might not always be easy to watch, but like many things we look at now, look at the show, the musical Showboat. It's very similar in that way. A really important piece of musical theater, a groundbreaking piece back in 1927. And the themes of that were not very well received at the time as well. But now it really is an important historical and theatrical piece, as Porgy and Bess is as well.
So when you bring that forward into 2013, what are some of the challenges in making it relevant to an audience today, other than just the gorgeous music?
Well, it certainly is gorgeous music, but I think sadly, a lot of the themes are still there in many, if you watch the evening news, a lot of the themes of prejudice and those kind of things are still with us today. They may be taking different forms, but a lot of the basic themes are items that we're still dealing with today. So hopefully it will shine maybe a new light on that, and maybe we can learn something from history in what we learn in Porgy and Bess, and maybe make that come through in some way today. I think that's an important part about the piece and many pieces of its genre.
As we said at the beginning of this interview, this is your last show as the artistic director. I assume that you're going to be coming back.
That certainly is the plan.
Yeah.
The reason I'm leaving, it felt like it was time for a new chapter for me in my life, and also probably a new chapter for the Skylight. It's been an incredible 9 years. I have learned a great deal. I hope I've contributed to the Skylight and to the Milwaukee arts community, but I wanted to go while I still loved it. So many colleagues over the years said, gosh, I stayed a year or two too long, different arts administrators, and I didn't want that ever to be the case for myself. And it felt like this was the right time for both myself and the company. But the Skylight will always be a part of my life. My first show was back in 1981 in the Chorus. So it's been 32 years of relationship with the Skylight. And I don't think that's going to end now. It will just take another turn.
So what is next for you?
What is next is I have been appointed the director of opera at the University of Iowa starting this fall.
Congratulations.
And thank you so much. I am really looking forward to it. I've done a lot of guest work in universities around the country, both as a stage director and teaching master classes. I love working with university students. And I do have a history at the University of Iowa as a guest there for the past 15 years. So the opening came up for the full-time position, and I applied and was accepted and feel incredibly fortunate to have the opportunity. I always hoped at some point in my career to spend some time full-time in a university setting, and now that opportunity has arisen, and I look forward to it greatly.
Well, Bill, it has been wonderful the last 7 years of talking to you, because that's as long as I've been here. And I'm going to miss having you sitting across from me on a regular basis. But I do hope you'll stop by when you come back to guest, whenever that happens to be.
I would love to stop. And thank you, Barney, for all of your support of Skylight. And it's been a great 7 years for me as well.
And break a leg on Porgy and Bess.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Bill Tyson is the stage director and choreographer for the Skylight Music Theater's production of Porgy and Bess, which opens tomorrow. The production will end his 9-year tenure as artistic director at the organization. New artistic director Vishwa Subbaraman takes over the position next season. Tyson has been associated with Skylight since 1981. He spoke with Bonnie North, and there is a link to more information about the production from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. One last break, and then a new magazine prepares to launch in Milwaukee with a singular, delicious aim. We'll learn more in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Earlier in the show, we heard about Milwaukee Magazine's effort to compile the definitive food lover's guide to the city. This month, a new magazine launches that has a specific focus on food here. Edible Milwaukee is part of a network of regional food magazines. It features an advisory panel of local people in the know about the food scene. Jen Ed is publisher and editor-in-chief. Among the advisors to the magazine are Young Kim, Venus Williams, and Justin Johnson. They all joined Lake Effect's Susan Bentz recently, and Ed explained how her background in Russian informs her current role.
I realized that even though I was studying languages and culture and literature, I always studied them through the lens of food. And so that led me to work for a time as a personal chef with this roving locavore catering service, and to also start just writing about food. And at that time, Vintage Eats was born, which is now a section of the magazine. So Vintage Eats wrote about and aggregated all of this information on local and sustainable food and just threw it out there for discussion.
You mean you did that?
I did that, yes. I'm sorry, I'm speaking in the third person. Vintage Eats, we did it. So that prolific sort of work, I felt like I was sort of bubbling over with all of these, you know, all of this newfound knowledge about local and sustainable food. That led me to a social media internship at Chefs Collaborative, which is a national nonprofit that helps chefs and restaurants make sustainable buying decisions. And then after my internship ended, I was hired on as development at Chefs Collaborative, got to know the edible people, and the rest is sort of history.
So talk about the edible community.
Sure. So Edible Communities is a network of magazines, about 80 over the U.S. and Canada, and each is locally owned and oriented, which is really cool. So we're each hyper-focused on the city or territory in which we exist, but we're also part of this national network that allows us to sort of, I don't know how better to say it, to form this group with a lot of clout talking about all of the cool things that are happening in food in our area.
Not every edible has a board or has a consulting group. Is that correct?
Yes. Just going back to what we had talked about before, I hadn't been here in 10 years. And so for me to walk in and assume that I knew everything and that I could catch myself up fast enough to launch a magazine featuring the things that Milwaukee is doing that is important, I think it would have been unrealistic and even arrogant. So putting together an editorial advisory panel was very important to us because these people provide us with the knowledge and the experience from basically the very beginning. And they also reflect the very diverse perspectives that we want reflected in the magazine.
So, Young Kim, you direct Fondue Food Center. Edible from other cities has been part of your vocabulary?
All the edibles have been a part of my vocabulary. I've seen them at airports. I guess I had some misgivings early on because there was so much worship of food. I'm more of a practical eater, you know. I'm not so interested in berries harvested by vegan children who are 10 years old. You know, it gets to be a bit much. I mean, you have to be able to eat it, you know, and it has to be affordable. And so my first meeting with Jen, I think I asked, maybe bluntly, maybe not so bluntly, I said, I said, you know, well, what kind of edible is this going to be? Because if it's going to be worshiping, you know, this rare mushroom that pops up every 5 years in some forest, no, I don't want to be a part of it. It has to be about everyday people. It has to be about Milwaukee, which has so much going for it. And it's time we had our own edible that has its own spin on things that... because this city does need to stand out.
What do you think this publication could mean to the people with whom you work?
Well, I think what it means to the folks that I work with, that the Fondue Food Center works with, is that food can be fun. It can be so meaningful, and it doesn't have to cost an arm and a leg, and it doesn't have to take 2 hours, 5 hours to make something good that's good and meaningful that tells a story about your family. It's like art. It shows what is happening or what was happening when a dish was created. And I think family lives are richer if they know where the food is coming from or if this is grandma's recipe. Or I think everybody could be encouraged to delve deeper into their own family recipe histories.
So, Justin Johnson, you come from a different slice of this picture. Your work is based in Watertown, right? And you're a chef. You're bringing in different perspective on what Edible Milwaukee could, maybe should be. What are your thoughts?
I guess the main reason that I wanted to be involved with the magazine was because I felt after a certain amount of time working in the business that it wasn't enough just to work. You know, I wanted to contribute more and know more and do more. So that for me meant writing, and I'm a fan of publications, print publications, you know, the beauty of something laid out and designed. And then I'm, you know, trying to, I guess, bridge the gap a little bit between Watertown and Milwaukee, because all of these awesome stories that we're talking about, based primarily in Milwaukee and for Milwaukeeans. A lot of that stuff is a little bit off the radar for, you know, people out in Watertown, and there isn't as much of a farmer's market presence or a grow your own food presence or even a sorry Watertown, a good restaurant presence, you know, in terms of that farm to table kind of thing. I guess, you know, how the magazine, you know, ties into that is to, I guess, make those smaller communities, you know, Watertown just being one of them, but I grew up in Slinger, and that would be another one, you know, making those outlying places where you would think there would be more agriculture because there's more land and space to do so, but making those people feel like they're more a part of the network and more a part of the city, you know, in terms of what's going on with food.
So reeling back into the city, close by to where we're sitting tonight, Venus Williams, you coordinate lots of programs in Alice's Garden. What were your thoughts coming into this team?
Well, when Jen first contacted me, she felt like she needed to convince me to do this. But what she didn't know is when I arrive in any city, one of the first things I do, if I have not done it beforehand, is to see if they have an edible. And so some of my favorites are, you know, edible Santa Fe, edible New Orleans. And so for me to have an edible come to town and for the invitation to help shape it was just like Christmas morning. I hope that part of what it becomes is what those other edibles are for me when I go to other cities. It's kind of a pulse of where I might want to eat and where I need to go. So it's kind of a field trip guide for me. And I think that along with everything that everyone has said about what this magazine will do for those who are already here or in the surrounding area, it cannot be overlooked that it's going to also be a roadmap for people as they come into the city. The other thing for me and my work, especially as the executive director of Alice's Garden, is I'm looking forward to using the magazine as a piece of curriculum in our training project with our Earn and Learn students. So it'll help me to expose all of those other great venues to some of the people who don't always venture out, who stick with the familiar, who sometimes just want to eat what they recognize or go into neighborhoods that they have been in before and not venture into other areas. So I see this magazine as a way to even bridge communities and bridge relationships. And what better way to do that than with food?
Ultimately, the magazine is for everybody. It's supposed to be for everybody. We don't want people to look at the magazine and think this isn't for me, you know, because I'm not in this income bracket or I don't have these political leanings or this seems like a magazine for a certain type of person with recipes for using ingredients that I can't afford or, you know, it's the idea is that it's you know, for the people, it's for everybody.
I think I can speak for all of us when I say that. I hope that food does become a unifier in a city that is sometimes divided. And what better way really to meet people on the same plane than through food? It's just a very easy way to relate and to learn something deeper about the person that you wouldn't necessarily learn any other way.
Jen Ed is the publisher and editor-in-chief of the new magazine Edible Milwaukee, which launches this weekend at a fundraising event. Among the magazine's advisors are Young Kim of Fondy Food Center, Venus Williams of Alice's Garden, and Justin Johnson of Harvest Market in Watertown. They spoke with Susan Bentz, and there is a link to more information from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. That's all for the Thursday edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next. ¶¶